Welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. Tonight we conclude our special series, The Landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft. In the first two episodes, we met Schoolcraft and talked about how the places he saw in 1818 have changed in the 200 years since the New Englander walked across the Ozarks. He covered some 900 miles in 90 days, and the journal he published remains a great guide through Missouri's environment on the eve of statehood in 1820. My name is Trevor Harris, and in the next half hour, we'll head to Springfield and talk about landscape change from the very different perspectives of an author, a pair of foresters, and an archaeologist. When Henry Rowe Schoolcraft set out on his walk across the Ozarks in 1818, he was an entrepreneur. He was looking for lead that could be mined and fields that could be plowed. His journal of 1820 was an invitation to land-hungry Easterners who already had one foot out the door, heading west. In his journal, Schoolcraft mentions clear, unpolluted streams, vast, unbroken prairies, and the presence of many deer, coyote, and bison. Out of print for many years, Schoolcraft's journal was reprinted in 1996 by the University of Arkansas Press. Missouri State University was still Southwest Missouri State then, when geographer Milton Rafferty reprinted Schoolcraft's journal. Rafferty drew inspiration and information from the students who he took on field trips to retrace segments of Schoolcraft's route. I met Milton Rafferty at his home in Springfield, where the retired professor and his wife Emma Jean are surrounded by a lifetime of learning and travels across the globe.
My name is Milton Rafferty. I was born in Jewell County, Kansas, which is about halfway across Kansas, right up by the Nebraska line. And I grew up in a rural community, as it still is. And after going into the Army and serving a couple of years in the Army, I decided I'd try some college. And so I started as a little bit older student because I'd already wasted 3 years of my life. College just changed my life right around. I would say my military service did too. It really opened doors I didn't know existed. And I found out I could do well in college, and I got interested in, I started out as an accounting major and ended up as a geography major. And that led me into studies of the land and people. I got acquainted with the literature, what there was of it, and source materials. That led to me teaching a course on the geography of the Ozarks. So I tried to find things to read about this area. And I ran across Carl Sauer's Geography of the Ozark Highlands. That's a great book. And then I ran across the Schoolcraft Journal, and I just was fascinated with that journal. So when I got down here, I started using it to teach my classes. Because I like to take examples of local geography and show them how much things change over time. So there's a great passage in Schoolcraft where he talks about riding out on the prairie, Kickapoo Prairie, which is essentially Springfield today. And I would tell the students to go look out the window and see what they saw. And then I'd read them that paragraph or two from Schoolcraft where he told about riding out into a prairie where the grass grew so high it hit a man on horseback. And that's what the tall grass prairie looks like when it's native. That was just a great, great example for students to see how much change. Of course, that immediate area of the campus, you know, became, I suppose, first a subdivision, probably originally a farm, then it became a subdivision, and then it became a university, and so there's been a trip. That'll probably hold it there, though. It won't be changing much after it gets institutionalized. It was probably back in the early 70s. The students and I would go out, and we'd take along Schoolcraft's journal. I made a Xerox copy of it. They have the original copy in the Springfield Greene County Library, but they won't loan it out. But they did let me copy it. And I would have the students read sections of that, and we would go out and trace Schoolcraft's route. Among other things we did, that was we would take a section of his route and trace it as well as we could.
And then would you go and walk that path as best you could?
Sure, we did.
Did you
sure.
Did you call property owners first, or did you just set out with a white flag?
Well, where we could, we did contact people. Now, Ashley's Cave is a pretty famous place along Schoolcraft's route, over near the current river. The people who own that property is a large company from Pennsylvania, and I could never get in touch with them. So in that case, I had to go onto the property there just to see it. I had a hard time finding that cave. It's pretty well known now, but at that time, hardly anyone knew about it. I finally found a farmer there who took me down to the cave on his tractor. I tried to drive down from the north side into what is today Ashley Creek, but I couldn't get down. I had a four-wheel drive SUV, but it was too rough. I couldn't get through. So I went to the south side and found on another trip, I went over there. And once I got there, then I did take some students down through the cave and let them see something that was really interesting.
And Schoolcraft found it. Was he looking for it because he knew there was a saltpeter mine there?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. He, a man from Potosi was making saltpeter there. At the time Schoolcraft got there, the mines had been shut down because they'd had an explosion of their gunpowder making factory, which is what the saltpeter was used for. He went out of business, and he went on to become Missouri's first lieutenant governor. There is a story of his life, and he found the saltpeter by just riding through along the creek there, and his horse got mired down in it, and he had a hard time getting his horse out of the saltpeter. It's kind of mushy, I gathered.
So is it like a derivative of the limestone that's being dissolved, or is it related to guano, or a combination of the two?
I think it's really the bat manure.
That's highly explosive, apparently.
Well, after they work it over, they have to clean it up, and they use ashes from a wood fire, and that sort of acts as a catalyst in purifying the saltpeter. And then it was hauled back to Potosi, so that they had been running wagons out to that mine for some time.
Retired Missouri State University geographer Professor Milton Rafferty used field trips and photocopies of Henry Rose Schoolcraft's journal to introduce undergraduate geography students to landscape change. 20 years ago, he republished Henry Rose Schoolcraft's journal with the title taken from the journal, Root Pursuits and Rugged Peaks. Another author intrigued by landscape change is Paul Nelson. Before he retired after a career as a forester for a pair of public agencies, Nelson published The Terrestrial Natural Communities of Missouri, a Bible of landscape types for public land managers here in the state. Here, Nelson talks about the native populations who inhabited Missouri and how they used fire to shape the landscape to meet their needs.
During the development of the Terrestrial Natural Communities of Missouri, I had a number of people who worked with me, including archaeologists and others who have studied the history of Native Americans from their time of settlement. And in Missouri, that goes back to almost 12,500 years with initial settlements, at least evidence of that down around Springfield, Missouri. So we know that Native Americans have occupied much of North America, and particularly the state of Missouri, for thousands of years. And those Native Americans have had a tremendous influence upon the shaping the character of our landscape, primarily through history and depending upon the climate and the conditions of the climate, because it's varied over thousands of years. But they've shaped it many ways. One of those was with the use of fire. And Native Americans periodically set fire to the landscape for a variety of reasons. And it's because of that, that much, in fact, of all of North America, its character at the time of settlement by people like Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, who explored much of the Ozarks of Missouri and Arkansas, as well as many other explorers and settlers and trappers and naturalists, found a landscape that was varied and quite different from what it is today and what we see in the modern world. And that landscape and its character looked the way that it did because of the common use of fire by Native Americans, which almost occurred on an annual basis. When Europeans came to North America, you have to remember that people in Europe lived in a landscape that was very much controlled, you know, through its populations and its governments. And so whatever occurred upon the landscape was governed by different people who were overseeing various different countries and cities and our territories and regions. And fire wasn't a part of the culture in Europe. In fact, what was a part of the culture, because the landscape there was so manipulated for thousands of years that, you know, practically every tree had a tag or a marker on it so that you were able to track the growth of trees. You know, forestry was very much a controlled part of the culture in Europe. The environment really in Europe was not very conducive to fire because of climate. Whereas in North America, fire, along with its sources either coming from Native Americans or lightning for thousands of years, was just a norm. It was a part of that culture and that landscape. So when Europeans arrived, their immediate assumption was that fire was a very negative and bad influence upon the landscape, so they worked hard to suppress fire that was used by Native Americans, as well as fire that was ignited and started through lightning and our other sources.
That was author Paul Nelson talking about how different cultures use fire or don't use fire on the landscape. The Missouri that Henry Rowe Schoolcraft saw in 1818 was one altered for thousands of years by seasonal wildfires. After widespread suppression, fire's making a comeback on some public and private lands. Here's natural history biologist for the Missouri Department of Conservation, John George, discussing what's happened at one Missouri farm where corn and beans have been replaced by native grasses and flowers that are genetically accustomed to the occasional torching.
Changes in land management, when you're talking about natural communities, it requires patience to see them. You know, you can't create a forest overnight. Similarly, you can't create a prairie overnight. But the Prairie Fork Conservation Area, which is got a bunch of partners over there, Edward Jones Associations, the heir to the founding family for Edward Jones Investments, it was their farm. And on that particular piece of property over the last 15 years, we've been able to convert it from, you know, corn and soybeans on about 400 acres to a really diverse prairie mix. And preliminary data has shown that, you know, mammals, small mammals utilizing the property have responded accordingly and increased in abundance and species diversity. And pollinators, the insects, invertebrates, have increased accordingly because you go from a grain system with very few native species around at all or none to where you have over 100 native species doing their thing, flowering, fruiting, producing seed, providing habitat. That's been really neat because I remember the fields when they were still crop fields, and now you can walk through them and we collect seed off of them for planting on other acres. And it's a continuing success story. And of course, one of the objectives for that area and the benefactor is that it be used for education, research, and restoration. And it suits those roles very well. University of Missouri does a lot of things out there. A lot of grade school students come out there and learn things. College techniques classes come out there and learn things. MU researchers, you know, learn new things about hydrology and fisheries and other animal composition groups and how they respond to these restored grassland settings.
That was John George with the Missouri Department of Conservation talking about how his agency is working to restore the landscape on the Prairie Fork Conservation Area. This is The Landscapes of Henry Rose Schoolcraft, a series looking at the forces that have altered the face of Missouri's lands. I'm your host, Trevor Harris. This is the third episode in a three-part series where we're looking at the forces that have altered landscapes in the great state of Missouri over the last 200 years since entrepreneur and explorer Henry Rose Schoolcraft set out at the tender young age of 25. He spent 90 days walking through the Ozark wilderness with travel companion Levi Pettibone. He walked nearly 900 miles. Another person with a unique take on the landscapes of Henry Rose Schoolcraft is Tom Peters. He's the director of libraries at Missouri State University in Springfield. On a recent visit with Peters, I asked him about some of the more significant forces that have affected the landscapes of southern Missouri since Schoolcraft walked through now almost 200 years ago.
Damming projects in the Ozarks have been significant. So we have a lot of reservoirs now. And so I don't think they even recognize the White River today, that they came up and went down both directions. I think also just road development and urban development. Even, you know, when you get into the less populated areas of the Ozarks, you still see, the joke is, you know, some of these small towns are basically suburbs of Chicago because there's so many Chicagoland retirees living around there. And just so how that's developed and, you know, how, like I said, the streams, the sort of the watershed aspect of it. You know, not a lot of industrial development. I do think that the forests have changed radically from the forests that they experienced. And just the mix of forests and open spaces is radically different. And then last but not least, beef cattle seem to be the agricultural commodity that reigns supreme currently in the Ozarks. But if you read like Brooks Blevins' History of the Ozarks, it's amazing to me how many things we have tried to grow in the Ozarks. Tobacco, cotton, strawberries, apples, chickens, it just goes on and on. And we've tried to grow about everything. And right now, dairy cattle were big for a while. Tomatoes were big for a while. And now it seems to be beef cattle. They'd probably just be shocked at that.
So the opposite question, what would look the most familiar to them, in your opinion?
You know, I think those sort of long-distance views that you get in the Ozarks where you see the balds and, you know, that probably is not a lot different than the kind of long-view visions that they saw as they were hiking over the Ozark terrain.
That's Tom Peters, Director of Libraries at Missouri State University in Springfield, discussing the ways that the Ozark landscapes are similar and different from when Henry Rose Schoolcraft walked through almost 200 years ago. The journal that he published of his Ozark travels remains one of the premier descriptions of pre-settlement landscape in the Missouri Ozarks. Timbering has also altered the Missouri that Schoolcraft saw in 1818 when he passed through our state. Many of Missouri's private landowners let their woodlots grow into a thicket of trees, rarely thinning their collective biomass. Public agencies managing our forest regularly provide notice of a timber sale. Francis Main works as a resource forester for the Missouri Department of Conservation in that agency's Springfield office. Recently, she talked with me about why and how her agency harvests timber from public lands.
Our basic mission within the forestry division is to ensure a sustainable forest where we can always get products out of our forest to use, but that we never run out of them. And we actually grow more timber each year than we cut. So we're doing a pretty good job of making sure we have wood to use without using it up. It's constantly changing, so there's really no permanent end goal. There is no complete climax forest because that climax forest will go away. And you get the early successional forest and it just keeps going. But basically our goal is to make sure that we have the mix of trees and species that will maintain the wildlife uses and a continuous forest product. So it's really going on diversity is what we're looking for. So I never want to cut all of any species out of the forest.
Besides managing her agency's properties, Missouri Department of Conservation resource forester Francis Main will also work with private landowners to manage their woodlots, a process that invariably alters the landscape.
The biggest thing that I need to know to manage your property for you appropriately is what are your objectives? Do you use it just for recreation, for hunting, for beauty, or do you want me to grow you timber products as fast as I can? And that would affect how I manage your forest. But overall, what you're looking for is long-term health, knowing which species live how long. And then, just like us, as humans, a tree, if it gets stressed because of overcrowding, that's when insect and disease problems attack. So I want to keep each tree out there growing vigorously, which a lot of times means thinning out the bad ones, leaving the good ones, and allowing them to use all that sunlight and nutrients to grow vigorously to keep the forest healthy overall. And then you want that good mix of species so that you have different foods, different types of mast coming at different times of year for the wildlife to benefit from, and then long-term products also. Can't be in a hurry if you're a forester, because trees take a while to change and landscapes take a while to change. So if you're a short-sighted person that needs instant gratification, forestry might not be for you.
Maybe you should think about blueberries or something.
Yeah, something of crops that grow in a year or something.
You pick strawberry operation.
So far in this evening's show, we've talked about landscape change from the perspective of a geographer, a pair of foresters, and a biologist. Another profession intimately interested in landscape change is archaeology. Jack Ray is the assistant director of the Center for Archaeological Research that's located on the campus of Missouri State University in Springfield. Ray recently told me what he finds when he looks at landscapes on the micro level.
We do what's called contract archaeology. So we bid on archaeological projects that are done in advance of construction, say like highway construction, waterline construction, development of airports, reservoirs, stuff like that. So we actually do archaeology in the field and then bring the artifacts that we recover from excavations in the field back to the lab to process, analyze, wash, and so forth here at the Center for Archaeological Research. And then we store the materials here as well.
Coolest thing you found lately on a project like that?
Well, probably the most amazing find was I found the distal half of a Clovis point, which is about 13,500 years old, which refit onto the bottom half that a local collector found 17 years earlier. So I found that at the Big Eddy site in 2002. That was pretty amazing. You don't find two fragments of the same spear point 17 years apart, but we did.
That's like a career moment.
It was pretty amazing. Not only was it rare to find some refit, two fragments refit back together, but Clovis points are very rare, and I had never really found one prior to that. So, and I've been working in the Ozarks for 30 years.
That's Jack Ray. He knows Henryville Schoolcraft, too. The archaeologist is interested in doing a dig at a site where he thinks Schoolcraft encountered abandoned seasonal Osage hunting camps on his walk through southern Missouri in 1818.
So how do you start? You've got the journal. You've got a general idea of where these were.
Well, based on his description, his day-to-day descriptions in his daily journal, he describes falling into the Swan Creek Valley from, he came up from the mouth of the Beaver Creek, which is the adjacent tributary of the White River. So he describes coming into the valley, and roughly based on his descriptions of what's called a bald, it's a large hill without any vegetation on it. We know more or less where that is, and so we know he started his trek along Swan Creek north of that point, and then about 9 miles upstream, he talks about leaving the Swan Creek Valley on a northwest course, and that northwest course almost has to be Elkhorn Creek. And so that's where he left. So there's about a 8 or 9 mile stretch between where he first came into the valley, somewhere around the present community called Garrison, and where he left Swan Creek Valley at the tributary of Elkhorn Creek. So somewhere within the 9 mile stretch, he passed three Osage hunting camps. So that narrows it down to some extent. Now, about 2 months ago, I canoed the lower half of this 9 miles on a kind of a reconnoiter to find out. I got some topographic maps and I highlighted the areas that were large enough to accommodate 100 men. Schoolcraft mentions that each of these camps may have quartered as many as 100 people. And so it has to be a fairly large terrace to do that. So I encircled on these topographic maps, all these terraces along Swan Creek, and there happened to be about nine in that 5 mile section, the lower half of that 9 miles. There's no indication on the topographic map whether it's a floodplain or a terrace. So I had to actually get out onto the creek and walk out onto these landscapes. So I canoed those lower 5 miles, and I was able to eliminate half of the potential places where they camped based on half of them were floodplains, and the other half were terraces. And they're not going to encamp on a floodplain for a month or more. They're not in this valley for just a day or two. These hunting camps were established where they built huts and everything. They were living there for a month or more. And so they're going to live on a place that's not going to get flooded, so a higher terrace. And so by just getting out of the canoe and walking these landscapes and seeing that one is only 10 feet high, that's a floodplain, whereas the other ones are 18 feet high, I was able to eliminate half of those potential hunting campsites.
That was Jack Ray, the Assistant Director of Missouri State University's Center for Archaeological Studies. Landscape modifications, such as timbering and agriculture, have had major impacts on the Ozarks landscape. For archaeologists such as Ray, this can be the difference between finding artifacts or finding nothing. While native populations manage the Ozark landscapes with fire, we Americans of the modern era manage often more indirectly through our agriculture, ranching, mining, and timber harvesting. In this series, we've introduced you to the voices behind those landscape changes. As we near the 200th anniversary of Missouri's statehood, now seem like a good time to look at where our environment has been. Through listening to these voices, we've heard about trends that will likely continue to shape our shared landscapes for years to come. My thanks to the guests on this program, Milton Rafferty, Paul Nelson, John George, Francis Main, Tom Peters, and Jack Ray. Support for this series comes from the Missouri Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. You can listen to past episodes on our website, kbia.org. Click on Programs and you'll find Thinking Out Loud. We close the show this evening with Backwater from Springfield band Big Smith. For the show's executive producer, Darren Helwidge, I'm Trevor Harris, thanking you for listening to the Landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft on Thinking Out Loud, right here on KBIA.
If you feed the chickens, and I'll chop their heads off. If you do the feather picking, well, I'll talk to your daddy. He's waiting in the kitchen. I'll get his blessing and we can stop this itching. I'll give you a son if you give me a daughter. We'll settle down and raise him right here in this backwater. This backwater. You flow up.